It's Saturday, November 9th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org, and it is time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch. I'm playing host today. And with me in the studio is Lyle Troxell, programmer, photographer, father, and part-time radio host. Also Ben Jaffe, a technology teacher, musician, web developer, and organic farmer enthusiast. So not a farmer yourself, just
a fan
of
them. Is this in my title?
Hey,
now?
Man, you can edit the file, too.
Welcome, fun. Gentlemen. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. It's good to be here.
Hey, you know, I heard a couple of things over the course of the week, but none of them were just this absolute barrage of geek news that the two of you have found to report on today.
Yeah, so, there's tons.
There's tons and tons, so I think we should get to it. And first, I'm just going for the scariest one. Robots and knives!
No!
No, run!
We've been talking about robots for so many years now.
And they've been scary every time. Well,
they've been pretty... Yeah, I mean, the robot baby, the robot dog that could, like, balance itself on ice. But it seemed like everything was okay as long as we kept them away from the knives.
I was concerned when they started throwing around those cement bricks, though. That was a little scary.
God, that was scary. Yeah, robot news. Gosh. Well, Cornell robotics researchers have decided that a grocery store checkout clerk should be replaced with a robot. Of course,
with a knife.
What's the knife story with that?
And they sell knives at the grocery store.
That's for convenience store protection. Robot protection.
That's actually exactly what it is. So you can buy a lot of things at the grocery store. You can buy eggs. You can buy a cereal box. You can buy knives. All three of these things are handled completely differently. Like the cereal box, you can flip that around upside down, whatever you want. It's not going to get damaged. The eggs, you don't want to do that. The knife, you can't wave that in somebody's face.
Look out.
Yeah, I know.
Here is your knife.
Oops. I love this video, too, because...
Oh, it comes with a video.
Yeah, it comes with a video. Basically, the idea behind this robot is that when the robot does something unsafe or potentially damaging to eggs or something like that, mm-hmm. you press a red button, and that stops the robot. And it...
Okay.
And it puts it...
Ma, Della, we're going to die from all the robots.
Where's the red button?
I can't find the red button.
Oh, well.
And so you press the red button, it stops it. It puts it into this mode that they call zero-G mode, which is basically it lets you manipulate the robot hand.
Okay.
So you can, like, let's say the robot waves the knife right up into your face. You press the red button, and then you move the knife away from your face. And the robot figures out after a couple of these times, you know, maybe the human doesn't like the knife in their face. Maybe the robot
Possibly.
Should do something else, you know, like turn the knife away from the human.
So it's like training a two-year-old.
It's like training a two-year-old, except
it has no
robot.
Feelings.
Yeah, and it's infinitely strong and, you know.
So is the red button like the clicker for dogs?
Yeah, right.
Oh, well, I did
like,
that wrong.
No, not that. But so anyway, I mean, it's actually compelling technology, but the video is just so funny to me because you've got this robot standing where the human checker is supposed to be,
uh-huh.
and it waves this knife in the human's face, and the human, like, intentionally, like, waits and doesn't react until the last minute, and then it's like, whoa, in the video. It's clearly a little bit theatrical. And hits the red button and everything, and then, you know, adjusts the robot.
There's something about this I'm not understanding.
Hmm.
So why have they programmed a response to a red button as opposed to just learning not to throw knives in people's faces?
Because you can't give the rules to the computer system for everything. And I think the most likely what you have to do is you have to train it to have some kind of intuition to what's right and what's not right.
Yeah.
So the knife, waving the knife in the face of a human is bad.
Yeah.
We all agree it's bad.
Yeah.
'Cause it's sharp. But if the robot waved a whisk, which is also a kitchen utensil that has the same look and feel, almost, it's metal, a person's going to be like, eh. And if the robot were like, aimed a whisk at you and like shook it maniacally, you'd be like, ha ha ha. You know, it doesn't matter.
It's a whisk.
Right,
it's
something with a knife, and you're like, ah.
Try again.
Exactly. Well, Ben, I have to say, I, for one, welcome our grocery store-employed egg and knife-wielding robot overlords. Just to let you know, when they come for us, I'm on their side. Sorry.
What? Anyway, you guys, if for no other reason, you should visit geekspeak.org and take a look at this video. The funniest thing about it, yeah, right after the show, after they correct it and tell it, no, don't wave that towards my midsection, the robot gives it a couple different alternatives. It says, okay, well, here? I can wave it towards your feet. I can wave it towards your face.
How about not waving?
So they correct it again, and then it learns. It's pretty cool.
Is this what they mean by situational awareness?
Yeah, absolutely.
So learning what situations are good and what aren't and what to do each one.
I mean, imagine, you know, a human being for our intelligence, it takes a long time for human beings to be appropriate in that kind of way. Yeah. I mean, I have 8-year-olds, and still, they might wave a knife incorrectly, you know, especially when they're not thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And over time, partially with the impact of pain and feeling other people's pain, you start learning when it's appropriate, when it's not. I mean, just last night we were at the fire pit doing marshmallows, and my son kind of put a stick about 2 inches from my face, aimed it at me. And, you know, I could see the play in that. If I were playing with him at the same time, that'd be fine. But I just turned and there was a stick in my eye.
Yeah,
I didn't get hurt. Yeah. But it's like that awareness is just not necessary. It takes time.
And where was the red button for what?
I said, no, not face.
It was the red button.
Not face.
Face bad.
Language is such a convenient thing.
Yeah,
even when you can't use it very well, like myself. Like me, I do not sometimes do.
Good said.
Thanks.
Yeah. Hey, Lyle, remember how last week we were freaking out about Google taking over Portland, Maine and the area?
One of the takeaways I had from you and me yesterday, last week's show, talking about Google, was you kind of called me a Google freak that I was turning into kind of a... And I've been looking at myself and going, Bonnie's right, all week.
Come on, you've been wearing that thing on your face for months.
Yeah, and then so they're building these weird floating barge things.
Right.
There's more pictures that Google finally announced, by the way, and there's pictures of that.
Is it official? It's really just a store?
It's not really a store. It's like an event, a venue. They'll be able to take 1,000 people a day through it and travels. And it looks kind of neat. But this week, more news about Google doing crazy things. Apparently, Google is about to break ground on a new structure, but this is an unusual one in my mind, and that is that at the San Jose International Airport, they will be taking 29-acre lot, and they'll be building a private Google terminal, a new terminal at San Jose Airport built by Google.
Having their own party at the party? What are they doing?
Yeah. They've had a Moffett Field venue for their planes. They have private jets, you know, big corporation, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
They also have like one of the vomit comets where, you know, it goes to 0G and you can experience that.
They have one of those too. I thought that was just Virgin.
Yeah, they've got one of those. And they've been at Moffett Field, and they spend about $1.5 million a year in the federal, since 2007, for the federal government for that Moffett Field space. They're going to keep that Moffett Field space, and now they're going to invest $82 million in a new terminal at San Jose International Airport. It's the largest private terminal in 30 years.
But I don't need to be concerned, right? They still go by be evil.
They're not going to be evil, so
really?
You're totally fine.
Can I really trust them? Why do they need...
I don't know why. I mean, it does make sense in some sense that they've got their own planes. Why not? But I don't know. They fly a lot of people, I'm assuming. In any case, this will actually have some space in it for other companies to use it as well. So it's not going to be completely theirs.
Right.
But it's interesting to see who has time to invest in airports. Google has that, I guess.
I heard there's another mainstay of the internet that could use some investment, and it's the Internet Archive, Ben.
Yeah, the Internet Archive recently had a fire at the house.
Can we just explain really quickly what the Internet Archive... It's kind of like the big library of Congress, but just for internet things and not governmentally owned.
Yeah, definitely. The Internet Archive and the Wayback Machine, they store snapshots of the internet at various points in time. So you can go back to a website, say CNN.com or something, and take a look at it in the Wayback Machine and look at the snapshots from all these different dates throughout the years going back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's...
And the Internet Archive's mission, which is just fantastic, is universal access to all knowledge. That's their goal.
That impresses me.
Yeah, pretty impressive.
So they are like a library in that they're sort of like a... They have taken upon themselves to be the collector of all the things.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they currently have 10 petabytes of data.
That's a lot of data.
That's a lot of data. That was for Ben.
So wow. when they had a fire, did some of that take a hit?
So no archive data was destroyed, but a lot of materials that were awaiting archive were.
Oh.
And they'll have to rebuild a lot. And so
horrible. The stuff that they didn't have archived yet got destroyed?
Yeah.
That's not good. That's against their mission. That's horrible.
Bad fire.
I didn't realize there was data knowledge loss. That's a sad kind of thing.
Yeah, that is a big bummer. But there is something you can do to help if you happen to be a ridiculously wealthy listener of GeekSpeak and you haven't contacted the station to give money to us. Give money to the Wayback, or to the Internet Archive. They're just I don't have a single negative or sketchy thing to say about them, which is kind of amazing in this day.
A force for good.
They really are a force for good. So if you have extra money and you're looking for someone to donate to and you want to donate to the tech sector, that would be a good place to consider.
Yeah,
I agree.
It's a public resource that needs our help.
Fantastic.
So Internet Archive, will have a link up at the website geekspeak.org after the show. So take a look there and then follow the links to goodness. Speaking of links and things, I really need to go from here.
There's a lot of them, isn't there?
There really is. I can't even fit it all in one page.
Well, you know, I've been really into Android devices lately. And Ben, you got a little Android story, right?
Yes, I do have an Android story. I have to find it in my massive number of links now. Okay, so...
Jumping around, sorry.
Anyway, yeah, I know. Like, wow, it's so unpredictable. So here's a quick story. If you have an Android phone and you bought it from, say, someone, if it's a Samsung phone, this is just the example I'm using because I have a Samsung Android phone. If you have a phone that's made by one of these vendors, one of the great things about Android is that you can take the Android operating system and add things onto it. You can modify it. You can do all kinds of things to it, right? Unlike iOS, which is a closed system. But the downside of that is if you buy a Samsung device, let's say, you're going to be buying a device that is Android fundamentally, but they've made changes to make it their own. And sometimes that can be bad. Sometimes that can mean that you don't get updates very quickly from Google when they update the Android project, and other various things. And a lot of people complain about all of the junkware that come with your phone. Like, for example, there are a whole number of Samsung applications that I actually cannot uninstall. They're the only applications on my phone that I cannot uninstall.
I don't get it. I mean, there's carriers that control some stuff on phones.
Uh-huh.
There's manufacturers that control some stuff on phones, like Samsung's a manufacturer.
Yeah.
And then there's the operating system as well. And what you're saying is that it just kind of stacks up. So when you get a Samsung phone, even though it's Android, there's tons of stuff on it that you didn't necessarily want.
Yeah, Samsung stuff. Yeah.
And that's actually not essential stuff?
Well,
sometimes you can't erase that stuff because it's essential stuff.
Yeah.
Pretty much none of it is essential. I mean, from what I can tell, Samsung has an app for everything that Google has an app for.
Yes,
so
I see.
Maybe someday in the future they'll move away from Android and do... I don't really know. But it seems that everything that I use Google for, I also have a Samsung app that I can't uninstall that claims to do the same thing. I don't know if they're good apps. I don't know if they're bad apps. I don't know if they're well designed or reliable or whatever, but I don't want them on my phone because I don't use them. So it turns out that there's actually a way to not to uninstall them, but to disable them. When you have an application on an Android device, this often will go for other OSs like iOS as well. If you have an application on your device, that application might run when your device starts because it might need to get updates from the server, or it might need to, you know, notify you if you have new mail, that kind of stuff, right? I don't want any of these apps that I don't actually want on my phone, I don't want them running either,
mm-hmm.
and potentially using up data or using up CPU or anything like that, and potentially introducing security holes.
Yeah.
So what you can do is you can go into the app manager and you can uninstall all of the updates to these apps, which brings them back to their stock default state. And then the same button that you clicked now is called disable.
Ooh.
And you can click disable. That doesn't uninstall it. They still take up memory on your device, like storage space.
Yeah.
But they're not going to be running when you start up your phone.
So it'll mean for a quicker running phone.
Yeah, exactly. Another way you could do it is you can root your phone. No, yeah. You can't root all phones. You can root most of them. It's really, it'll void your warranty.
Yeah,
it's
it becomes quite problematic. Like, and then if you root a phone and the carrier finds out that it is, it might disable some services.
So should I not worry about what rooting a phone is then? It's not a good idea.
Yeah, it's kind of bypassing the operating system and kind of doing your own thing, basically taking over the hardware.
That's classically kind of tricky, right?
Yeah, well,
phone
on phones,
manufacturers don't like it.
Yeah, right.
Some
on your computer,
really
it's like the standard thing. You install an operating system, you're rooting the computer. I mean, in the sense that you're just installing a new operating system.
Yeah.
But this idea that our phones are locked down a little bit more for protection, kind of, or their power over
their
us.
Their protection.
Really. Yeah. No, I've got some more Android news, actually.
Well, let's hear about that after a break, shall we?
Okay, that sounds great.
It's GeekSpeak here on 88.9 KUSP. Our website is geekspeak.com. This is GeekSpeak, the show you are listening to right now on 88.9 KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, hosting today with Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe, also in the air room. And Lyle, you were going to say some more stuff about Android.
Yes.
But I do want to correct, it's geekspeak.org.
.org, excuse me. I calmed it.
Because we're a nonprofit.
Sorry,
those
you guys.
Because none of us make any money.
I accidentally calmed.
If you own geekspeak.com and you want to give it to us, that'd be fine.
Yes, you're welcome.
Oh, that'd be great.
Please, I don't know.
Please
like
contact
org.
Us at geeks at geekspeak.org.
Yeah,
and we'll talk about .com.
So the thing I want to say is I've got a Nexus 5 for a week now or so, and I love it. It's the new Google phone. It's theoretically a low-cost phone, but it's not that inexpensive. And you have different options in buying it, and it kind of ties in with Ben's story. You can buy it directly from Google at the Play Store, which we'd pay the fee that would cost to make the device and sell it and all that. Or you can buy it through Sprint or T-Mobile. And when you buy it through Sprint and T-Mobile, the whole idea there is that they normally offer some kind of incentive. You're signing up a contract with them, and therefore they reduce the cost of the phone. That's how
right.
it normally works.
Yeah.
But people are looking at what T-Mobile's offering on this phone, and they add up the incentive versus their other phones, and they're realizing that actually the cost if you buy the phone through T-Mobile is more than if you were to buy it directly from the Play Store. In fact, like $100 more, which is a little strange. But it's not totally unheard of because it's possible, and this is what T-Mobile's kind of saying and inferring, is that Google's actually losing money on these phones when they sell them directly.
Yeah.
And so...
But it's so that they have them in your hands and then they become yours.
I guess.
Like if they give you an opportunity to get a cool new device that's not available to everyone, then you might become like a super big advocate for that thing.
I like the thing on my face, Bonnie. Come on.
I noticed that you had said earlier in the show that you'd been reflecting on how much you've let Google into your life.
Yeah, too much.
And it's still evident.
Okay, I'm glad it's still evident. So one of the things that T-Mobile's doing is they're not allowing Wi-Fi calling through this device, even though they offer that through other devices. Yeah. This means when you are in like a rural environment where you don't have good cell phone coverage, but let's say somehow you also have Wi-Fi at your house, you have some network from either a DSL line or something of that nature.
Well, you can hook up that way.
You can actually call on T-Mobile. It's very common to be able to call somebody like a normal phone completely through Wi-Fi, which is very cool when you don't have good cell phone coverage. It's one of the major reasons why people use T-Mobile.
So why not have that on the...
They're not saying. And it's not about the features of the phone. It's just they're not doing it. I don't know why. I'm assuming they're trying to pick up more revenue through the expense of the calling costs. If you call through Wi-Fi, it doesn't count against your minutes bill for calling. So it could be that they're trying to pull in more revenue on a side channel because they're not making a lot of money on the device. I don't know. But I just thought it was interesting.
You know, Google may be losing money on Android, but you know who's making money on Android?
Who?
Microsoft. $2 billion per year in revenue from Android patent royalties.
Ah.
And you know what they're using that money to compensate for?
What, Ben? Tell us.
The fact that they're losing money on Skype, Xbox, and Windows Phone. So it's kind of interesting.
Oh, it's subsidizing their Skype activities?
Yeah. Everybody's losing money on phones.
Well, actually...
I feel like I'm spending so much friggin' money on my phone.
Why isn't it getting into the coffers?
Well, just to be clear, according to this particular article that I'm reading, of the $2.5 billion that they're probably losing on Skype, Xbox, and Windows Phone, $2 billion of them, that's like 80% of it, is Xbox, the Xbox platform. So maybe Skype and Windows Phone, they're losing a little bit more.
So I don't understand how you do business at large scale and lose lots of money and just keep going.
There's probably an end in sight, ideally, right?
I always thought they were losing money on like the game console system, but all the people that make games actually spit back funds for them so that it comes out as a head.
Yeah.
But it's also about, you know, winning market share so that you have, I mean, that's a big thing is,
I guess if you're in all of these, if you have your hands in all these different pots and you're so huge, you can afford to, you know, throw away a couple billion dollars on this or that just to make sure that you're the top player. It's kind of crazy. Of course, Microsoft isn't necessarily the top player in a lot of these things.
Bonnie, was that enough news about phones, Google, and Microsoft and such
That'll
for you?
That'll be quite enough.
Can we sum that up on the Android Spice?
Yeah.
All right,
Hey, Ben, you're kind of our space correspondent.
You got it.
And I hear you've got a story about supernova detection. This is interesting. I was just reading about how difficult it can be to spot a supernova because it's at the very point at which things kind of a star blows up and then dies.
Yeah, it's
to
like
to have your eyeballs in the right part of space at the right time is quite a trick.
That's exactly the problem. You can't really film an explosion until after it's happened, unless you know it's about to happen, right?
Yeah, so, they're quick, right?
Yeah, they're pretty quick, yeah. But what we really want to capture is the moment that we first see it go supernova. The really cool thing about supernova is that there's actually a way that we can detect them a little bit early. I'll explain that in just a second. The story that's bringing me to this topic is that they are building a supernova in Japan, in a mountain in Japan, and it'll come online, could come online as early as 2016.
I'm a little concerned that they're building a supernova right on the planet, because as I understand it, you can be like 5 million miles away from one of those things and still be affected by the blast.
I think Ben dropped a word.
I'm sorry.
They're building a supernova. Let's all say it together. It's detector.
Detector. Okay. Good.
It's true. I accidentally a word.
I'm just going to express some mild concern about a supernova being built on our planet.
So enjoy your week.
So it's what? Being built in a mountain in Japan?
It's not actually a supernova detector as much as it's actually a neutrino detector. So here's how this works. Basically, neutrinos, I'm not going to go really deep into this, but basically neutrinos are these crazy particles that don't interact with any other matter via electromagnetic or strong nuclear interactions. Right. They only interact via the weak nuclear force. The weak nuclear force, true to its name, is very weak, which means that if you shoot these supernovas...
You're weak.
Thanks, man. If you shoot these supernovas... if you shoot these neutrinos through objects, you know, like your hand, it'll just pass right through because it's going between all of the atoms in your hand. Now, if you shot one of these neutrinos through the Earth, it would just go right through. It's incredibly unlikely that it would actually hit anything.
Because it basically has to really hit a particle.
It's just...
It has to really collide.
Extremely unlikely.
I mean, nothing.
Does it matter if you could just like nudge up against it? What about glancing blows?
Well, so actually, that's exactly right. When you put your hand on the table, like my hand is right now, we feel the table pushing back. But that's not because the atoms in my hand are touching the atoms in the table. The atoms in my hand are almost entirely empty space. They are so infinitesimally small, which is really cool. The reason is because we have these different forces that are making these atoms repel at great distances relative to their size. But it's
sort of important
repel.
That they be apart from each other
for the whole
world works
matter thing going on.
So,
yeah.
So what we have here is we've got these neutrinos, which are super duper duper small,
which ignore all those forces.
Yeah, they just ignore all the forces, so they can just pass right through.
Is it that they ignore them, or that they're so small that
they just don't interact with
those forces? The quality
of
them is they don't interact, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like you can't say, oh, we have a photon. Well, why is that? Is it just so small that... No. It's just totally different from an electron or anything else.
So it's kind of mind-blowing all by itself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of like... I mean, an electron and a proton inversely interact with each other in electronic in the field, and the neutron doesn't have interaction in that field.
Yeah,
you know, the three
not part of the conversation.
I'm just passing
through.
It's pretty cool. Okay, so
all
empty space. Neutrinos don't interact. Yeah, they go through the entire planet. How do you detect them, Ben?
Let me give you a couple stats. Yeah. First of all, okay.
If you're sitting in a room and you feel a chilled wind, even though there are no windows, could be a neutrino.
Okay, so supernova 1987A. Guess what year that happened? 1987.
The first part.
Yeah. So supernova 1987A. I need to back up. Okay, hold on. Let me go for just a second and just explain all this. So when a supernova happens, in the core of the star, it creates a massive, massive amount of neutrinos. And those neutrinos just sail right through the rest of the star because the star is actually mostly empty space and the neutrinos can go in between all the atoms. And so the neutrinos go from the center of the exploding star straight out.
Uh-huh.
all the rest of the star, all the matter, all of that stuff, that has to kind of bounce around inside the star for a while before it reaches the surface. Whoa. Then it explodes. See? So, in other words, if we could find some way to detect this burst of neutrinos, then we would know, oh, there's about a supernova is about to happen.
Uh-huh.
And we can, through some other methods, figure out roughly what area of the sky is. And then we could also look at all the stars that we think are most likely going to go supernova, point our telescopes at those, and then within a couple minutes, the star explodes.
Cool.
Because we caught the neutrinos, which went straight through the star, versus the explosion, which had to bounce around in the star.
Oh, that's awesome.
Here are the stats I was going to give you. From supernova 1987A, from the neutrino detection experiments around the world at the time, they detected a flood of neutrino signals, and that flood of neutrino signals was 24. They detected neutrinos. 24 neutrinos. Now, to be clear, for about, this is an estimation, for about 13 seconds, every single square foot of the Earth was bombarded by 100 trillion neutrinos. 100 trillion neutrinos went through the Earth over
every square foot.
And we detected 24 of them.
So we're still, it's a new science.
Yeah.
We're still getting the hang of it.
It's ridiculous. Now, we can't detect the rest of them because they're just not colliding with.
Right. So the only way to detect this is they collide with something, and that causes that thing to do something.
Exactly.
And
so
then you know that it was collision happened.
So it has to collide in the thing that you've set up for it to collide into.
Yeah.
I can't actually remember how we do the detection. I think we have these massive pools of something. I think it's chlorine or something like that.
No, I think
like
we
that.
Do water.
Is it?
Yeah.
So the neutrino.
You need a lot of volume.
Whatever it is, you have these gigantic pools of water. A neutrino just happens to, of these 100 trillion neutrinos, maybe one of the neutrinos happens to hit one of the atoms in the pool, or the molecules in the pool. And it changes that molecule from whatever it is to something slightly different.
Throwing off some energy.
And then we say, ah, something changed there. That's a neutrino event. We detected 24 within that 13 seconds, and we figured out there's a supernova. Now,
and to be clear, that pool of water, one of those molecules has to be hit by a neutrino. And then the energy that it shoots off when it does that, the change, the free electron, whatever, has to then get a hit at a detector. So it's extremely hard. So the more detectors, the better we are at detectors of those pools, the more likely we are to detect the event.
Absolutely. So
but I still
it's
want to
just
get,
so cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
It's really cool. And also, right now, every one of us have I don't have a number, so I'm just going to say gajillions of neutrinos passing through us right now and not interacting with us. It's so interesting to think that these things exist.
Yeah, I sort of get an image of like a constant rain.
Yeah.
It's just constantly raining neutrinos. And
Also, one last statistic. At current estimated rates of supernova formation in the Milky Way, the odds of one popping off in the next 50 years, the article says, could be as high as 90%, which means that now that we have this new detector online, almost online, will be online in a couple years, within the next 50 years, we're probably going to see a supernova, and we might be able to have our cameras pointed at it at exactly that moment. So, anyway, blah blah blah. That's supernovas and that's neutrinos, and it's really fun to read more about it. So I'm going to post both of these articles up on geekspeak.org.
You can imagine. Oh, anyway, yeah, it's just amazing the whole thing. But actually catching something in the act like that just drives me. It's just a shocker. So it sounds like New York thinks it's caught Airbnb in the act of something that it shouldn't be doing, and that's sort of interesting to me, Lyle, because that's sort of a an internet 2.0 way that people are making a dollar.
Yeah, and full disclosure here, I participate in Airbnb. We actually have a unit on the property that I don't actually get proceeds from it because I'm a renter as well, but I help manage it and all that.
Okay.
So Airbnb is a website that allows you to register a house or an apartment or a room or a trailer or a tree fort and say, hey, you can come stay in this for the night for this much money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bread and breakfast kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also go up, of course, and find a place to stay.
Yeah.
And this is really fun way to see a city, I have to say, because sometimes it'll be a room in somebody's house and they're there too. And you meet them, you say hi, you don't know who they are, but you need to be in some area. And it's kind of a new cool thing. And what Airbnb really does is it traffics the money for you. So all the credit card transactions go through you, and then they pay out the people and they take a percentage off the top.
Mm-hmm.
And they also handle disputes, things of that nature.
Oh.
So it's kind of a cool, a little safer way of doing that than just like, you know, randomly calling people in an area code you want to visit. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you get pictures and you get social reviews of people's Airbnb experience.
So people can rate, like, oh, this is a good place to stay, or well, this one's
right.
good.
Or, like, this member's been around for this long and he's got 5 stars. And,
yeah.
Or, yeah. So yeah. It's kind of a cool feature. Now, if you take a place like New York, where there's lots of places to stay all the time, there's probably a lot of empty rooms every night in New York, right? Because that's just how the world works, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's actually really expensive to be there, even for a night.
It costs a fortune.
It costs
to
a fortune.
Rent there.
Yeah. So if it
it's
costs
like
a fortune.
$400 for a one bedroom, I heard.
Yeah, that's insane.
It's cocoa.
So let's say you figure out how to way to get a two bedroom house or a one bedroom house, but then you're dating somebody and you're, I don't know, you're going away for the weekend.
Yeah.
Sure, be nice to get some revenue for that, right? So that's kind of where the Airbnb place fits. But the truth is, there's a lot of hotels that also have vacancies in New York every night. So if
is
you're
this a
hotel,
competition thing? Is this a competition
kind of.
Story?
So if you're a hotel and you want to rent a room and you know all these people are going to Airbnb, gosh, it sure would be cool to just use Airbnb.
Oh.
Okay, so there's a lot of use of Airbnb for some place like New York. So then the attorney's office, district attorney's office, filed a request to Airbnb saying, look, most likely people that are actually hotels and should be paying taxes on anybody staying here, because, of course, New York raises a lot of money, a lot of tax money, revenue, from extra fees on top of rent house of hotels.
Yeah.
In fact, if you look at your hotel bill, you'll notice that there's always a city value, which is just about visiting. And New York makes a lot of money off that. So the district attorney is like, look, we like your service. It's great and all that, but we want to have figures. We know some people are breaking the law, and we want information about those users.
Now, isn't this a thing where not just hotels should be paying tax, but anyone who's making money off of...
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure
where it comes down in that regard.
Is it one of those fuzzy kind of gray market things?
Yeah, I think it's city. I think it's based around the regions.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a tricky question. And Airbnb is kind of like, you know, that's your responsibility.
Oh.
Because they don't want to be an expert in every area.
Yeah.
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 So what's happened is, and I'll just quote the district attorney's office of New York. It says, we began this process in the hopes of collaborating with Airbnb to recover millions of dollars in unpaid taxes and to stop the abuse of Airbnb's site by operators of illegal hotels. And this is a statement to CNN, or CNET, excuse me. Unfortunately, Airbnb chose instead to obstruct those efforts and lie about our objectives. Airbnb isn't standing up for the average New Yorkers who rent out their apartments from time to time. Airbnb is standing up for highly profitable illegal businesses which make up a huge chunk of its corporate revenue. So that's what the issue is.
So is the district attorney saying that hotels are using the site when they shouldn't be, or that anyone using the site is essentially a hotel?
No. The district attorney's office is feeling like if you're going out of town or you want to rent your room for a little bit, fine.
That's fine.
It's like, you know, cities rarely tax people to do garage sales.
Okay.
It's that kind of gray space.
But
they're not trying to go after that. Yeah.
Okay.
They could have a policy in place which did that, but then you'd be living in a world that was a little less free.
Well, it's kind of like how people are shutting down the lemonade stands. It's a little different.
Yeah, it depends on your area, but you don't really want to be in an area like that. Yeah. So what they're concerned about is that these large hotels are booking all their revenue through that and they're hiding it. Or they're not even a registered hotel. Like, let's say you have a building in New York and you have 15 tenants that aren't there and you book it every single night. And that's kind of like a hotel if you're making lots of money. And what the district attorney is saying, look, we just want help. We want to find those people and get their taxes from them. And Airbnb is saying, you want to get all our user data. And so there's this fight about what the truth is there. Airbnb is claiming the district attorney wants all user information of New York users.
Yeah.
And the district attorney is saying, no, we're not saying that. What we're saying is we want these legal hotel companies. These things is the ones we want to hit.
Well, this is so interesting because there's the public conversation.
Yeah.
And then there's whatever the private conversation is between the district attorney and Airbnb. And I wonder
I don't know
how those are different.
Exactly. It's really quite interesting.
Because is it just interpretable or did they say one thing in private and have said another thing in public? Or?
Yeah, well, the attorney's office is saying that Airbnb is lying in their public statements.
Wow, that's a big charge.
The thing is, I kind of feel like, I mean, it's definitely true that officials will sometimes get their ego involved.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to say, I trust the district attorney to claim about this case. I trust their statement more than the PR statement of a large corporation like Airbnb.
So then what are the implications?
The implications would be that
you can't dress yourself in an NSA cloak and do what you want.
That's the interesting thing is it does kind of feel that way, right? When you're talking about government controlling business and all that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that I hope that Airbnb will change their policy and be very clear. But the truth is, as Airbnb has grown, if a lot of their revenue comes from these large hotel-type businesses and the district wants to come in and step in there, Airbnb is going to get hit financially pretty hard.
Yeah.
They're going to lose a lot of revenue or a lot of customers. And I could see, you know, more secretive sites coming up to do the same type of thing, the shadow net, if you will. So I don't know how Airbnb is going to handle it. It's kind of depressing. It's definitely something I care about because I use the service. I also feel like I have a little bit of sourness around Airbnb in the sense that it does feel like it's somehow stepping...
If it did lie, that's not really
I don't like that.
Due diligence kind of.
So there's the Airbnb update.
Ooh. All right. Well, why don't we find out more what's happening out there in the world of tech after a break here on GeekSpeak on 88.9 KUSP. It's GeekSpeak on 88.9 KUSP, KUSP.org, also GeekSpeak.org, a place where you can find out more about this episode and years of episodes in the past. My name is Bonnie Jean Primsch. I'm hosting today with Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe, also in the air room. And, you know, we're on kind of a tip of getting mildly creeped out. So let's talk about driverless cars. How's that going?
See, that's the problem with driverless cars is that people get really creeped out by them.
How do you trust them?
Well, do you trust yourself to drive?
Most of the time.
No.
So Lyle, I think.
Lyle does not.
Lyle's got it down.
Oh.
So yeah, I mean, studies show that humans think they're fine and humans are quite bad drivers.
Yeah.
So,
in fact, the only way you can know you're an okay driver is to think you're not an okay driver and compensate the entire time.
Oh, yeah,
that's why we go slower. Right.
Yeah.
You go slower, you make sure the space in front of you, you double think when somebody's about to enter. You know, it's called defensive driving, but it's basically saying you're not as good as you think you are. Compensate intellectually for that.
I wish defensive driving was called driving. wouldn't that be great?
Unless you're in the post-apocalyptic Australia, in which case it's always offensive driving.
Offensive driving.
Offensive driving.
That's not offensive driving.
I wasn't even going to try that accent
live on the air.
That was
thank
good.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well done. So I've got some interesting statistics from this article on Computer World, just talking about how people feel about driverless cars and what it would take to get people using driverless cars.
Mm.
And of course, also what would happen if people did. So first of all, there were two surveys that were discussed in this article. One is by carinsurance.com and one is by the nonprofit NO Center for Transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what these things say are more than a third of the people surveyed said that an 80% discount on car insurance rates would basically persuade them, sure, I'll buy an autonomous car. Now that's 80% off. That's quite a lot. So if your car insurance rates are $200, that's rates of 40, you know, $40.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty low. But at the same time, that kind of makes sense, especially if you had a lot of driverless cars on the road. Some of the other estimates are if we had 10% of all the US vehicles self-driving, the number of accidents every year would be cut by 200,000. There'd be 200,000 fewer accidents.
Which means less fatalities is two.
It's just like
over 1,000 less fatalities.
Oh my gosh.
Over
we'd save 1,000 lives a year.
1,100 lives a
by
year.
By just trusting the robot overlords.
Yes, and economic costs would be reduced by an estimated $22.7 billion.
What about the expense of all the robots?
Well, that's a good question.
Think of the robots.
So that's 10%. If we had 10% in the U.S., we'd have 200,000 fewer accidents, 1,000 lives saved, $22 billion saved. If 90% of the vehicles were self-driving, we'd have 4.2 million fewer accidents.
How many lives?
21,700.
So if we just switch to robotic cars, even not all of them, but most of them robotic cars. So the classic cars, I think, could stay on the road. They'd be around robot cars all the time.
Yeah.
If we did that, we'd save 21,000 lives a year.
Yeah, 21,700.
So why aren't we doing that?
And
because it's creepy? Or just is it just a matter of time? I think it's probably just a matter of time,
yeah,
right?
450 billion, too.
Well, isn't it also just kind of getting used to the idea of accommodating driverless cars and what it means?
I think it's the tech getting there and infrastructure in place. We already have all the cars that aren't self-driving.
I really don't want them to malfunction.
I don't want them to malfunction, but
we malfunction every day.
Yes, we sure do.
We malfunction every day, all the time, whether it results in an accident or not.
The truth is right now, if we didn't have cars, and let's say we had roads for some reason, but we had no cars.
Yeah.
Right. if I said to you, okay, now it's time to get cars, everyone will have a car and we'll just trust everyone not to hurt each other and they'll go 60 miles an hour. A horse and buggy environment would be like, you're insane. There's no way we're going to do that. That's crazy. Yeah. But that's the world we live in, right?
Yeah.
And so...
and it's incremental advances that brought us
the amount of death that happens from those overshoots so much things. I mean, we get upset about gun violence, of course, because it seems completely ridiculous that we have that. Yeah. But it's nothing compared to car violence. And
Yeah, it's true. True. I think... the biggest barrier, and you know, I'll eat my words if this is not true, but I think the biggest barrier to getting driverless cars on the road will be humans. Like, the technology will get there. Technology goes, it gets better so fast. It's exponential a lot of times. And in this case, it's not as exponential because it's software development, right? But at the same time, it's fast. That's my only point, right? Yeah.
They'll get really good really, really quickly.
Yeah. Building
tow truck
these
drivers
things.
Are going to have a fit. I mean, who stands to benefit from us being so sloppy with each other?
Yeah, that's true, I guess.
I guess.
That might be where objection, like what, well, they have to switch up what they're doing.
So, well, I think that also, you know, the cars are going to be more careful about problematics. Like right now when you get like an engine check light, you just go, oh, well, I'll get to that in a couple days. And hopefully it doesn't burn up your car beforehand. Maybe you put some oil in it and it still stays on. You'll, oh, I got to get that on Tuesday. But with a car that's robotic of nature, that sort, if it detects a malfunction of that sort and the engine light would go on, it's not going to drive anymore. Mm-hmm. It's going to go, okay, we're done.
But you know what?
Which is the better way to do it.
The light won't go on as early, though. I mean, think about it. If you have...
a light won't actually go on.
No.
The robot doesn't need
Dave,
that
Dave, you're
kind
not
of...
going anywhere.
But honestly, I mean, the reason, I think the reason it's okay when we decide, you know what, I'm just going to keep driving for another 5,000 miles and hopefully it'll be fine. The reason it's okay is because automakers compensate for our stupidity. They probably put on the light quite a bit earlier.
Yeah.
You know? A couple other quick statistics. 75% of respondents think that they can drive a car better than a computer, which I don't.
That's,
I mean, I think I'm a moderately good driver, but I do not trust myself over a computer that... I mean, computers you can get a lot more information into a computer.
I think if I gave you a car, Ben, and said, for the next 2 hours, you have to drive better than a robot, you would. Consciously, we probably can do it. The problem is we're not conscious individuals. We slip into other places all the time.
I actually would disagree with you there. I think that even if I was being as careful as I could, and as conscious as I could, I think I would probably
The robot's reflexes are gonna be faster.
Yeah, it's just true. The airbag goes off, and you're aware that so someone strikes you from the side. The airbag goes off in like 16 milliseconds,
right?
And fully inflates in like 32 or something.
And you build the narrative after that.
you realize that something has happened.
Yeah.
600 or 800 milliseconds after. That's almost a full second.
Right.
Like our reflexes, well, we think our reflexes are good because we are arrogant and whatever. I mean, we're not aware of how bad our reflexes are because we can't perceive how bad they are.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, Ben, I'm just realizing while you're saying this, I love you. You're awesome.
Sorry, it's because I'm a robot.
Because you're not
Dave.
A robot. But you're also the consciousness of our own imperfections, I think, is one of the things that humans have that's really an amazing trait. The ability to understand that we're not as great as we intuitively think.
Yeah.
That's really good. I like that trait.
And then Americans' ability to just toss that ability aside.
Kind of makes me sick. Exactly.
I do wish that was more prevalent.
Well, you know who thinks they're just the bee's knees is that AT&T.
Oh.
Can we all harp on them for a minute?
I would love to harp on AT&T.
Normally we have like the Facebook moment on the show or something, but I think it's time for a round of, you know,
hate
bash on AT&T.
AT&T. What's your carrier, Ben?
What is my carrier? Sprint.
Currently mine's AT&T. Do you guys like your carrier?
No.
Do you know anyone that actually likes their carrier?
Carrier?
Yes.
Who likes their carrier?
The only people who like their carrier are people who have carriers who use other carriers who are evil's networks. Like, you know, their networks like Ting and things like that.
Yes.
And they're using the Sprint network, I think it is. So, you know, maybe the company that you're paying directly is...
But how does that work?
Well, I'll actually talk about that in a little bit, but first let's hear Ben's story about evil.
Just to justify us talking about AT&T being evil, I actually do have a story about this. The CIA has been paying AT&T more than $10 million a year the article says, to assist with overseas counterterrorism investigation by exploiting the company's vast database of phone records, which includes Americans' international calls.
Is this part of the Snowden find?
This is according to government officials.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't think it had to do with the Snowden thing. But, I haven't read all of this article. But anyway, I mean, that's kind of disturbing. Now, this is not because of subpoenas or court orders or anything like that. This is a voluntary contract. AT&T has said, okay, sure, have this data.
You know, what
we'll
portion
take,
of that profit?
We'll take 10 or 12 or whatever million.
Yeah.
Which is really a bummer to hear.
Yeah. You know?
They're just happily, taking money and rolling over.
Yeah, especially given that as Americans, we barely have a choice in terms of what carrier we use. I mean, we can use AT&T, we can use T-Mobile. I think they're still separate, right? Yeah, that didn't go through. We can use Sprint, we can use Verizon. And, I mean, all of them have problems. AT&T probably has the best service. And so if you want good service, I mean, you
really
have to go with
that's
AT&T
the best
or Verizon.
Service? Oh, no.
Yeah.
I mean, forget anybody else then.
Basically.
It just sucks.
You know, so...
So how can providers that hop on the back of a provider do better than the provider if they need the provider
to go? So there are these larger corporations that own a whole bunch of antennas, right?
Yeah.
And they've been subsidized by the government to create those structures for years.
Yeah.
And so there's all this very complicated regulatory layer about what they can and cannot do with that system. Mm-hmm. And you'll see fights in court where, you know, it's kind of the same place as Comcast. You know, Comcast wants to do something a little different. They're a big cable company in this area. And because of the regulations on how they built their network and therefore how their proceeds got generated, the government said, these are the things you have to do and you can't do and all that. For example, a side effect of this kind of legislation is that there are local television stations subsidized by cable companies because the cable company wants to be in the area. The local the local government says, well, we'll give you access and bands. You can tear up the streets and all that. But to do that for every year, you have to give us some amount of money to invest in producing television locally. And that's why we have local television.
That's why we have local television.
And they're really kind of amazingly funded in some ways because cable companies are so successful at gouging us.
Yeah.
So cell phone companies, the same space. I'm not going to get into the details of that. But just so that you know, right now, if you have a Sprint service plan with your Sprint phone, you can actually go to a company called Ting, T-I-N-G, and get service from them. You will still use the same antennas, and theoretically it'll be exactly the same service, but you'll pay Ting a different amount of money.
Right.
And the money value is amazingly good. So I was curious because I had me and my partner had AT&T phones, and when I had an iPhone, it was actually locked. The antenna didn't support Sprint. There's actually different network antennas.
Yeah.
New phones kind of support both. So I started investigating, well, is there something other than AT&T I can use that's kind of like Ting where it's on top of it? And there are. There's like five or six of them. Mm-hmm. So I've picked the one that friends of mine use. And the difference in price here, I'll just take an average bill. My average bill for my iPhone-type device on AT&T is about $120 a month. Mm-hmm. It's expensive because I use extra features like tethering things, and they charge a bit more. The same coverage, in fact, theoretically, and that's only like 450 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. Unlimited with this other company, Net10, is $65 a month. So about half the price and more coverage, theoretically, using the same network. Now, I haven't activated it yet. I'm trying to deal with Net10, and I've been corresponding with AT&T and Net10 through chat, through their web services and through email, trying to get, and even through the phone, to try to get them to understand that I'm going to go talk about this on the radio. I'm going to attack AT&T. I'm going to say that you're wasting money if you're using the company. I'm going to suggest, you know, Net10, if you use that, it'll be better off. But the truth is, Net10 makes it extremely difficult to use their service. It's extremely difficult. I have to physically go buy something at a store. So there's like all these steps, and I'm not sure if it's regulatory, and the company's not talking about it. Anyway, I'll keep you apprised. It's going to be a bit of Lyle being complainant on GeekSpeak about cell phone companies. So I'm going to ask you this.
You're doing a little research.
I'm doing some research, but I'm also just going to kind of – it's ridiculous. At this point, it feels like we're being gouged. We've already built the networks up. It's just – I don't like it. Mm-hmm. So I want it to get better. So I invite people that have good stories about their cell phone company. If you think you're getting good service, if you know of good service, if you think you actually – know a little trick that's about cell phone companies, or you just have an interesting truth about them, I urge you to participate in the conversation and the dialogue with me at geekspeak.org. You can go and you can either follow us on Facebook or Twitter or Google Plus, whatever. You can do it there. We follow those. You can also just email us. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. And I'd love to hear some stories. I do have some people that know a lot about the infrastructures that have been laid out, and I plan on having them on the show too.
Yeah, good. All right, good.
Yeah. Hey, I've got some quick geek bits, and they're up on geekspeak.org. They will be after the show. Just two awesome astronomy pictures. First of all, Albert Einstein burned up in the atmosphere over reentry. That
was
actually a pod from the ISS. And also awesome eclipse pictures. So cool.
All right, GeekSpeak at geekspeak.org for Geek Bits. This has been GeekSpeak for November 9th, 2013. We're a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. That is GeekSpeak. This is 88.9 KUSP Public Radio and KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org. I'm Bonnie Primsch. I've been here with Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe, and thanks for listening.